all ready to work.
Our first speaker, was Tony Gardner from Birmingham. Tony is one of these people that that manages to do this amazing balancing act of being engaged in mathematics at the same time as being engaged in education. And he will talk to us about the question of what it is that we have now that it would be worthwhile handing down to future generations. He has said that he has rewritten his lecture several times, so I'm not quite sure what the title is. But I'm taking a stab. I think it might be Passing the Torch. So Passing the Torch, Tony Birmingham from Tony Birmingham.
Thank you. Well, I've adjusted it to what seems to be on the front of our folders, Beyond Numeracy. And this then, I guess, translates further as what is mathematical literacy as opposed to quantitative literacy? That's the sort of the core of the discipline which lies behind whatever numeracy might mean. And I guess, and how can we get more of it? I assume that as math teachers, we probably love, even in BC, where you can worship the sun and the hills and the beaches and have a rather relaxed lifestyle by other standards, I suspect math still appeals. And in the spirit of Gilbert and Sullivan, you've got to have a subtitle. So I guess I have a subtitle of Good Intentions Are Not Enough. And it's always difficult in mathematics education, appearing in strange places where local politics and local concerns are not necessarily understood by foreigners. But I've tried, and I have looked at various cuttings. So I don't know who Bruce McCaskill is, but I suspect you all have little plasticine effigies of him and stick pins in them when you get frustrated with the new grade 8-9 curriculum. And one's told, good intentions, it addresses the needs of all students. With the options and other stuff, your teachers, math teachers, president or leader? Is this a guy whose name people know?
Yes, at the
minute. Okay.
He is the president of BCAMT
now. Okay.
He was the vice president.
The idea is, if you reduce the amount of material covered, students can get a greater understanding of what's covered. Sounds wonderful. But they've taken this way too far. I only quote what I read. I assume this probably strikes some kind of core, and George Blumen, who I assume is boss of the maths department here, or
was
okay. While the rest of the world's focusing more on math, BC's moving away from it. That's his summary. And the good intentions of, clearly one would like the grade 8-9 curriculum to reach all students, but when you try and do that, you lose track, you lose something. And the question is whether you lose more than you gain. And it reminded me of something from the British Ministry of Education, which has been drafting core principles of teaching and learning, the first of which says rather blandly, ensure every learner succeeds. Motherhood and apple pie, if ever there was. So the problem in mathematics is that one may want to address the needs of all students, but in fact, it isn't quite that easy. And I want to try and address the mathematics that we perhaps don't want to lose. And I guess, I mean, reforms which are proposed are often meant to improve things, but they tend to have unwanted negative consequences, and I see my job as trying to get at, remind us of the sort of things we shouldn't forget if we're going to try and address the latest pressures to address quantitative literacy or numeracy, which are particularly strong in the UK, but you don't really want to hear about that. First, it seems to me we should not lose sight of the fact that mathematics lies at the centre of our modern society and what it has achieved. And this is a wonderful quote from George Steiner, a guy, an English professor, a polyglot, a man of superb talents right across the board. This is literature and literacy at the crossroads, which I think we could take as a kind of rallying call from somebody who doesn't have a particular reason to thump the mathematical tub. Most decisive change in the tenor of Western intellectual life since the 17th century is a submission of successively larger areas of knowledge to the modes and proceedings of mathematics. As has often been noted, a branch of inquiry passes from pre-science into science when it can be mathematically organized. It's the development within itself of formulaic and statistical means that gives to a science its dynamic possibilities. The tools of mathematical analysis transformed chemistry and physics from alchemy to the predictive sciences that they now are. It's a simplification, but it's getting at something important. I love the name. By virtue of mathematics, the stars move out of mythology into the astronomer's table. And as mathematics settles into the marrow of a science, the concepts of that science, its habits of invention and understanding, become steadily less reducible to those of common language. And even though it's a bit boring listening to my voice, I think it's worth reading. The whole of it, the notion of essential literacy is still rooted in classic values. In a sense of discourse, rhetoric, and poetics, but this is ignorance or sloth of imagination. Calculus, the laws of Carnot, Maxwell's conception of the electromagnetic field not only comprise areas of reality and action as great as those comprised by classic literacy, they probably give an image of the perceptible world truer to fact than can be derived from any structure of verbal assertion. So this is suggesting, in a sense, numeracy is much more basic in the modern world than literacy. And not just numeracy. This is not just number, not just calculating. It's something much more profound. All evidence suggests that the shapes of reality are mathematical. But integral, this is written by an English, a humanist, not by a mathematician. That integral and differential calculus are the alphabet of just perception, of correct understanding. The humanist today is in the position of those tenacious, aggrieved spirits, and he is a humanist. He writes as a humanist for humanists. Of those tenacious, aggrieved spirits who continue to envision the earth as a flat table after it had been circumnavigated, or who persisted in believing in occult propulsive energies that after Newton had formulated the laws of motion and inertia. Those of us who are compelled by our ignorance of exact science to imagine the universe through a veil of non-mathematical language inhabit an animate fiction. The actual facts of the case, the space-time continuum of relativity, the atomic structure, blah, blah, blah. It's no paradox to assert that in cardinal respects, reality now begins outside verbal language. Mathematicians know this. Andreas Spitzer, the wonderful German who tried to address these broader issues in the sort of 1930s and 40s. By its geometric and later by its purely symbolic construction, says Andreas Spitzer, mathematics shook off the fetters of language. And mathematics today is more efficient in its sphere of the intellectual world than the modern languages in their deplorable state, or even music, are on their respective fronts. Spitzer was the most cultured, humanistic inclined mathematician I think you'll ever hope to meet. So you've got an interesting contrast here, both from the humanist side and the mathematical side. Few humanists are aware of the scope and nature of this great change. Sartre is a notable exception, as he's referred to the crise de langage. I mean, if people want copies of this, I'm sure copies can be made. But it's a wonderful reminder that we have a tradition to represent which we should not undervalue. Mathematics is often a Cinderella subject. You feel that it's compulsory, but somehow it's not really appreciated as more than a bag of technical tricks. This is a reminder that I would suggest our unprecedented prosperity and well-being are direct consequences of that objectively rational mindset associated first with the ancient Greeks. And later with the Enlightenment in Europe, through which dispassionate objectivity, even at a cost, open inquiry, commitment to truth, were brought to the fore as guiding principles for a society, with all the cost that that entailed. Authority is thereby questioned. And the old certainties collapse. The things that you liked to believe in before are open to question and evaporate. And if you look at both periods, the ancient Greeks, say, in the late 4th century BC, just as this philosophical and mathematical openness blossoms, in some sense marks the beginning of the end of the great ancient Greece. The miracle of opening up the thought world in a new way marks the decline of the great empire. Alexander overextends himself, and around 300 BC, ancient Greece begins to fragment. So great things happen, it's a great idea, it challenges the authority of the world which gives it birth. The same if you look at the Enlightenment, the Renaissance, the scientific industrial revolution, you get the same kind of openness coming to challenge authority. Authority naturally wants to close it down a bit. But the openness wins out. It also ushers in the beginning of the end of the society that gives it birth. And this is very much part of the mathematical heritage. If you look at ancient Greece, you'll find that the openness of critical inquiry, of analysis, of proof, of what I put here is the refusal to tolerate a contradiction, which is at the heart of, for example, Euclid. All the way through, you suppose one thing, that leads to a nonsense, so that can't be true. It's exactly the same thing if you read the Socratic dialogues of Plato. Get you to say something, you get in a mess, so we have to reject that. It's the same kind of analysis that you'll find in open politics. And that's part of mathematics, it's part of what mathematics has given birth to. Okay, not only has it been rewritten several times, it doesn't necessarily fit together afterwards. So that was the first general principle, is that you've got this openness of criticism and analysis, which is part of mathematics, and which we should not forget as being something that one wants somehow to capture in school mathematics. The second thing I would like to try and stress is that I think it's too easy to forget. There are many plausible statements which contain a grain of truth that mathematics is all around us, that it's perfectly natural, and so on. I would like to stress the opposite, that mathematics itself is unnatural. You do not find it on the street corner. People do not lean against lampposts and do mathematics. They may do something. They may calculate in some way. They may make a living. But what they're doing is not really mathematics. It's a kind of pre-mathematics. And there's something inherently difficult about mathematics, and yet at the same time, it's profoundly human. There is a tension here, but I don't think you should deny it. I think you try and live with it, that in some ways it's unnatural, and yet the things that it develops, like language, are, as with language, touch a human nerve somewhere. And I think this gives us courage, first to recognize that mathematics is not going to be absorbed or mastered unless it is explicitly, carefully taught. And that, I claim, is necessarily going to be top-down in some sense. That you have to remember, when teaching mathematics, what it is, what the abstractions are that you are trying to attain, to sort of embed in the learner's mind at the end, to design roughly how you go at the task. And that, in some sense, is top-down, even though one has to start from where the learners are. The second point, that it's profoundly human, gives us some courage and reassurance that mathematics can be so framed as to strike a chord in young hearts and minds. And what I would like to do for the rest is more or less to take you on a journey, and you're going to need a pencil and some rough paper and do some work. I want to take you on a whiz tour through bits of elementary mathematics. But first, to try and decide which bits of mathematics that we're looking at, you don't want to read this, but it's taken from a dialogue involving Alain Conne, who is a Fields medalist, French Fields medalist, I think, called Conversations on Mind, Matter, and Mathematics with a French neuroscientist. Neuroscientists claim that they've got all this arithmetic and mathematics sussed. They can take scans of the brain when they're doing arithmetic or algebra or problem solving and tell you exactly what's going on. I don't believe a word of it. I think it's much more subtle than that. They found a new toy and they think they've discovered the heaven. So they sound terribly optimistic. Alain Kohn is much more concerned about trying to distinguish between routine mathematics and creativity. And so he has these three levels, which I'm going to use just for convenience. On the first level encompasses, for example, everything one does in upper level math during the last year, at least say in France. That I'm going to take as just techniques, routine techniques. He means more than that, but never mind. The second level begins when the actual method of calculation is adapted to and criticized in the context of a particular problem. I'm going to take that as meaning sort of problem solving beyond the routines that have been taught. The third level, which is what he's interested in, is creativity research, what you're doing when you make mathematics, when you invent or discover mathematics. So to summarize that, perhaps a slightly more familiar image. The first level, one has routine classwork, which one wants to establish as fluently and flexibly as possible, and which one tends to practice through what I'll call exercises. That is, they don't necessarily involve anything original or difficult. There's a second level, which is less familiar problem that you might call problem solving or applications or a flexible use of what you've learned, which brings in much more the reasoning, proof, links between parts of mathematics, and there's the third level we shan't discuss at all. But most of what I'm about to try and get you to do very quickly, so get your brains in gear, is in the blue box. And I don't know whether this... So we'll start with something which is sort of black. I don't know whether these things are familiar in Canada, are they? Cards with numbers on? 24 game? No? Well, it's worth... You've got four numbers. Your job's to make 24 using the four numbers and the four rules. Each number use once. Off you go. Make 24. If you tried adding them all up, you get 9 and 6 is 15 and 5 is 20 and 2 is 22. You're not there. You want to make 24. Okay, so addition's not going to do it for you, so you're going to have to use what? So multiplication, to get up bigger. Right, off you go. And wink at me when you...
You need how many?
You need to use each of them once.
Oh, you need to use all of them, though?
Each of them once. There's a chair. Winking's a bit slow.
It's easier if you don't write.
That's depends on... Writing can be a lubricant for the mind. Excellent. Those who think they're done can try 2 8s and 2 3s, which is a wonderful thing to have in reserve. Nobody asked the obvious question, which you'll get from kids, which is that, are they both the top one? You've got a 6 and a 9. Yeah? They're going to ask, are they both 2 6s or 2 9s?
Because you already said
it. All right, okay, yeah, sorry. gave it away.
My neighbor asked, but she asked me.
Okay. Well, I think if kids ask, one should smile sweetly and sort of say, what do you think? Don't make it up, but you can tell, because they've all got their bottoms towards the square in the middle, haven't they? So they're certainly different. How many of us have done the first one? Fingers. Keep going. You've got to get in the mode, get in gear. It's a classic example of the second box, the problem-oriented things. You're given the answer and you've got to find out how to create it. This is a kind of backwards use of mathematics. It's what I call addition, multiplication are direct handle-turning activities. They're black, they're the routines. What you want in mathematics is always the inverse of these. You want to be able to not multiply out brackets, you want to be able to factorize. You don't want to differentiate, you want to integrate. Clearly, to integrate, you've got to learn to differentiate fluently first. To factorize, you've got to multiply out first. But the aim in mathematics is always to be able to unpack, to do the inverse things, to problem solve rather than to just to calculate. And for that, the calculation needs to be really fluent. So, somebody give us the first one. Back row.
5 multiplied by 6.
5 sixes are 30.
2, 3, 3 plus 3.
Yeah, well, let's, if you stick with this, I mean, you're both the same. 6 times 5 is 30. Divide by 2 is 15. You can divide by 2 first or second, it's up to you. Once you've got 15, you can add 9 and get 24. I leave that to you. You can ignore what I say. How many of us have done the second one? 2 8s and 2 3s.
Same thing, 24.
Same thing, 24. Each number used once. I leave you to go to sleep now and ignore everything else I say. If you take nothing else from this hour, it is that very simple material can capture, in essence, the mathematical spirit. 2 8s and 2 3s, you can save that for the beach sometime. But, so, even at that, I mean, on a more mundane level, there are simple calculations at the black stage, the routine stage. This is something which, in England, is much neglected. A routine problem, two cyclists 42 kilometers apart are heading towards each other. They start at 8 a.m., 11 a.m., they meet. One of them's traveling at an average speed of 7.5 kilometers an hour. What's the average speed of the other cyclist? Do it quickly in your heads. And think what the kids need to do to master simple things of this kind. First, they've got to pick out what that isn't actually given.
3 hours.
Yeah? So you've got to extract that, and for most kids that's a step, it's easy, but you've got to do it. Then you've got to what? Pick up the...
How far one of them travels.
How far one of them travels, that's the sort of obvious way to go at it. Doing 7.5 kilometers an hour for how many hours before they meet?
Three.
So he'll take...
22.
He'll do 22.5 kilometers. Now we're going to subtract, and we'll get... 19.5, and that's in 3 hours. The other guy does 19.5, so we've got to divide. Okay?
Easier.
Pardon?
Easier.
Easier, we can save till break time. You can tell inquisitive people there is often an easier way in mathematics, but most people will not find the easier way to start with, and you may even wish to protect sensitive souls from being hit with a clever, clever way at the outset. If you think of relative velocity, it may actually be easier. Problems like this, word problems which are not, no, sorry, exercises like this, which are word problems that involve, what have we done? We've had to subtract, we've had to multiply, we've had to divide. The whole of arithmetic is in there with extracting information.
In England, what grade would this be a problem?
It is not done at all. I gave it to my third year math majors, about to graduate, and you would be horrified at the outcome. You would be horrified at the outcome. A third of them never got the answer in 5 minutes. And almost a quarter stopped at 19.5 over 3. Because for them, that is not a number. They cannot grasp 19.5 divided by 3 as an object. But when they have some buttons, then they can implement the instructions. But that's saying that there is a, we have got stuck at a level where even very simple things are not done, at least in some parts of the world. Maybe not in British Columbia, courtesy of Bruce McCaskill. Sorry. Much more important, Tom and Dick take 2 hours to do a job. Dick and Harry take 3 hours to do a job. Harry and Tom take 4 hours for the same job. How long would they take all working together? Well, I say mathematics is not natural. Unfortunately, I gave this to a bunch of 52 math teachers in two groups of 26 who'd all turned up to a gifted and talented day. So they were good teachers from good schools, interested in good kids. And I just let them do it. What did they write down first? I'll give you a clue. It was complete nonsense. How did they translate the first sentence? Think of the worst pupil student you can imagine who writes down what they think is an algebraic equation. For Tom, how are they going to represent Tom?
T plus D.
T and plus D D takes equals 2 hours. Two. T plus D is two. D plus H is three. H plus T is four. These are good teachers from good schools worrying about good kids in a country which, unlike BC perhaps, has not understood the nature of school algebra. It's not natural. If you leave people to do what's natural, they write nonsense. Right? The algebraic structure, which is that we want some number associated with Tom that we can add or combine with some number associated with Dick, has to be taught. And what do we have to do? Well, you've got two choices. You can either say, let T be the time it takes Tom to do the job on his own. Yeah? That is, T is the time Tom takes for one job. Or you can say, let T dashed be the part of the job that Tom will do in 1 hour. Okay? And one of these you can actually do arithmetic with. If Tom and Dick are working together, T dashed is what Tom will contribute in 1 hour. D dashed is what Dick will contribute in 1 hour. So in 1 hour, they will manage T dashed plus D dashed. Yeah? And these two numbers, T and T dashed, are related. They're reciprocals. Okay? But these are not natural. They can be understood. They are profoundly human in some sense, but they have to be taught, especially to English math teachers. Apparently. Now, I was horrified with that, but I wasn't entirely surprised, having lived there for a while. Let's look at something. What else was I going to say? Oh, yeah, we've had that. This is from a book of mine, which I'm sure is not to be found in British Columbia, but should, of course, be here. Big numbers. Do human beings live for as long as 1 million hours? Just write down what you would like kids to get towards if faced with this problem. They wouldn't do it as quickly as I hope you will do it. Do human beings live for as long as 1 million hours? Write down or imagine. Imagining's a bit of a cop-out because nobody knows whether you really did imagine it. What do you want them to do with 1 million hours? To translate it into?
Days.
Into days, maybe, to start with. And of course there is a problem here in that to translate into days we have to divide by 24. And for modern kids, the temptation is, of course, to divide by 24 and to lose completely what you're doing. But in some sense, as math teachers, the unnatural thing is we want them to think of it as that many days. And not to evaluate it necessarily. We want somehow them to hold what they have done and how you achieve that. And then you want to change it into?
Yes.
Years. So you want to divide that by 365, and it's not obvious to most English kids that it goes here. So So you want them to be able to have this algebraic structure of it, that it's actually the number of hours divided by the number of hours in a day and the number of days in a year. And to somehow, they won't have this to start with. The question is, how do you get from what they naturally want to do? And in England, if they were going to do this, and you start, I don't know, in grade 6 or something, they may, and you don't give them a calculator, and clearly there's a question here as to what role calculators play. If you give them a calculator, it undermines many of the things that you want to develop. They will do this, and right, they'll do the division, longhand. And then they may do that. And they may then notice that it goes at least one here, and so it's more than 100 years. Okay? So do human beings live as long as a million hours? Well, it seems unlikely. But there is a mixture of procedural ways to get an answer and structural ways to see what's going on. Does the world really want the answer? Does anybody care? Well, the answer's in the book, but who cares whether the answer is yes or no? Yeah, but the actual precise question is not so interesting. It's the method. It gives you some feeling for how long a million is, and as the questions go on, you realize that you're going to get sick of how big a million is. If you've lived for a million seconds, how many birthdays have you had? Well, you can try the same. You want a million seconds, and you're going to change it into minutes and hours and days, and then you may go on. So this is the number of days. But you've got the same repeating structure. It is not natural. It has to be cultivated. To leave things, this is deferred gratification. This is the problem of two-thirds. What's two-thirds? 2 divided by 3 equals 0.6 recurring. No, just two-thirds. Leave it as two-thirds. Don't evaluate. Hold it as an entity in your mind. Okay, that has to be taught. It's not natural. They want to evaluate. Is this true in BC as well as in England?
Yes, very much.
Yeah, okay. And in some sense, the calculator gets in the way here. Right? It pushes you towards evaluation. It's so easy. Whereas for mathematics, what you want is to hold the idea. Okay? The calculator is invaluable when you actually want the answer. When you care about the answer. But when you want to care about the method, the ideas, then you want to somehow hold this. I want to use sexual sort of analogies. You want to hold it in the foreplay. You don't want to go the whole hog straight away. Yeah? Enjoy, absorb. Let the important bits sink in. And clearly, that is not the way that kids will do it in general. When you do it with younger kids, their most natural way is the opposite way of multiplying up, of taking a life, 80 years or whatever, and knocking that down to hours. Yeah?
Mm-hmm. That's, I would be unhappy if a child did that.
Sure, but there is a difference. That belongs on the right-hand side of the board, except I haven't got time. Right? There's a contrast here, and you have to ask which it is that you want in the long run. Of course, I wouldn't be at all unhappy with that, but I think you want to move towards this as the more powerful. And then you can move on. So both of these, I'm sure many of you have seen, but for kids it's not natural. We can estimate. Not by guessing, but by getting a feeling for not just what a million is, but what base 10, how base 10 works. That the 24 is begging for mathematicians to be 25. Not for kids. For kids in England, it's 20. They're much happier with 20. And you have to cultivate the feeling that 25 is far better because 365 is begging to be
400
because 4 and 25 are just sort of wanting to get together and hug each other. Yeah? And then you can see it's 25 times 400, roughly, which is 10,000. So, and we've made the denominator bigger, consistently bigger, so the answer will be somewhat underestimated. So these, with estimating, it's not just getting a rough answer. It's knowing, controlling which side you're estimating. And you would want to underestimate or overestimate depending on whether you thought the answer was yes or no. If the answer was going to be yes, you do normally live this long, then you ought to overestimate the answer to get 60 years or 65 years. So there are subtle decisions here which are involved. And of course, later on...
If you ask the young child how long the person lives, he would say forever.
Well, I guess I'm not dealing with young children here. I mean, to leave you to... How long would it take to count to a million? You've got all sorts of estimates of how long each number takes. Which is the typical number when you're counting to a million? Do you care about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, or 76, or 142? What are most numbers when you're counting to a million? How many digits do they have? Well, most of them will have 6 digits. Do we actually care what the average 6-digit number takes? No, as mathematicians, we can scale down. We may as well assume each number takes a second. Why? Because if it takes 4.5 seconds on average, what can we do with the answer? Whatever answer we get for 1 second, if it should have been 4.5 seconds on average per number, we just scale up, multiply by 4.5. Anyway, why is 1 second such a wonderful thing to use? I didn't let you do it. But if we do this one down here, if you've lived for 1 million seconds, how many birthdays have you had? Then you've counted to 1 million. Okay, and here we have it again. 60 times 60 is what? 3,600. But we can't resist making it 4,000. And the 24, we can't resist making 25. So this is 4,000 times 25, which is 100,000. So it's 10 days. Now, this is a long teaching sequence, and we're compressing it. These things are not easy, and they have to go through the sort of the stages that you're quite happy with, but are not the final thing, and work towards the final sort of template of calculation that one's working towards. So, it's a little more than 10 days. How many birthdays have you had? Well, one, your only real birthday. Yes? And on it goes. So, again, you get a much better feeling for what a million or a billion is, which... It's amazing. In our world, with calculators and the numbers that fly around, kids now have a much more... they have no hold at all on what big numbers actually mean. There are numbers flying around them so much that they just don't pay attention to them. When we were little, some of us look old enough to... I can say we. Some of you look young enough, or you'll have to imagine. When we were little, big numbers were important. We hardly saw them. We hardly met them. So we learned to sort of pay attention to them and take some notice of them and get some feeling for them. Okay? In a world where these numbers are flying around, you actually have to work to give them a feeling for what these numbers mean. I'm not sure where I'm going to get to. Okay, there we are. Let's try another book that I'm sure is not to be found in British Columbia. Here we are. Do it as quickly as you can. There's a cross number. You've got to put numbers in the squares. And you're given these really helpful clues. 3 across is a cube. 4 across is another cube. Well, maybe the same cube. 1 down's a cube. Oh, 2 across, 2 down's a square, and 3 down's a cube. And nobody cares 2 hoots about the answer. You will not find this engraved in heaven. So it's just an exercise, a problem, a challenge to try and get across the character of mathematics. Where do you begin? Suppose you have somebody who nominally knows what a cube is, as many of the English kids do, but they don't really have a feeling for what cubes are or which numbers are cubes. They don't know any cubes. Every time they want to know a cube, a number times itself, they have to work it out. They can do the direct operation, what's 3 cubed? 3 times 3 times 3, and they may get 27, or they may not. But the feeling for using cubes, where are they going to start with this cross number? Which clue have you got a hope of beginning correctly?
There are so few three-digit cubes.
Pardon?
There are very few three-digit cubes.
There are few, but how many three-digit cubes are there? 4 cubed is 64, so 5 cubed, 6 cubed, 7 cubed, 8 cubed, 9 cubed. So there are 5 three-digit cubes we could try. So you could use trial and error.
Well, but only one of them will be and.
Maybe. So what are you going to say? three. I don't see which. You could try this with the final digits, but the final digits of cubes, are they very special? Final digits of squares are a bit special. So two down is a square. So that final digit has to be a 0, 1, 4, 5, 6, or 9. So 4 across is a cube that ends in one of those. This is getting a little bit messy. Yeah. Is there a place where you can just almost cut the Gordian knot and get started?
3 down.
Why does 3 down look good?
It's just a 2-digit cube.
So it's the same idea, but it's taken down a notch. 2-digit cubes are much rarer. How many 2-digit cubes are there? 27 and 64. They don't know that. How are they ever going to learn? Does it matter? Okay? But here, to find the chink, the crack that will allow you to get started, it's either 27 or 64. It's 3 down. Which of them can we... How do we decide which it is? Well, in England, kids try and show that it must be whatever by showing that works. So they'll take 27 and say, 3 across, a cube beginning with 2. 3 digits. So it could be... No, it must be. What?
3.
Pardon?
243.
We're getting 343 and 216 mixed up. 343 is 7 cubed, 216 is 6 cubed. So, yeah, it's got to be 216. But why couldn't it be 64? To know that it should be 27, you've got to eliminate the other one. That's not natural. That has to be taught. Yeah? Why couldn't it be 64? Is there a 3-digit cube starting with 6? Is there a 3-digit cube starting with 4? Do we care? Well, for which students do we care? Hey, this is not meant for all students, but it captures the spirit of detective work, which lies at the heart of much mathematics, which one would want to capture at whatever level of ability the kids are at. This material is all aimed at essentially the top 25% or so, at least in England, which in BC means about the top 60% perhaps, I don't know. Simple questions. Could you run a kilometer in 1 minute? How are kids going to react to this? What are they going to have to do? Well, adults tend to have a clear idea what the answer is, but what's a kid going to do? They don't have these sort of... What are they going to choose? What are they going to decide? Nobody ever runs a kilometer, so what are they going to think about?
Our kids run 800 meters, like we do.
Oh, okay.
Electric events, so they might be able to say, no, it took me... 5 minutes to run 800.
Well, young kids running 800 meters, I seem to remember 800 meters was one hell of a long way. You always thought twice around the track should be easy, but about halfway around the first, you think, whew. So, 800 meters would be one thing, but then you'd need to know roughly how long good runners take for 800 meters. It's difficult to time 10 meters, but people do tend to know. You've got to choose a unit anyway, whether it's 800 meters, a kilometer isn't, but what's a natural unit that they're likely to pick? 100. You get a sense of 100 meters. If you're really quick, you might do it in 10 seconds. If you're going to do it in a minute, each 100 meters would... Okay, this business of choosing a unit, breaking it down, it's got to be a familiar unit. There's a link between the nature of the question and your own experience. There's a question of underestimating and overestimating again. Okay, so lots of questions of that kind around. We might as well have this because give you something to read while I catch my breath. Proxima Centauri, you're given diameter of the Earth, diameter of the Sun. Sun's nearest star to the Earth is about 150 million kilometers away. Suppose you build a model with the Sun as an orange. Yeah? How big's the Earth?
Teeny.
How far away is it? Could you make that bit of the model in this room? Yeah? And again, it's not easy, but built into this is, again, just sort of proportional thinking. Anybody see a quick way, since I would never visit quick ways on kids, but Maybe we can see that underneath it's not nearly as hard as it feels when you first read it. It's that the same with the cross number. You read it, same as 2 threes and 2 eights. Anybody done 2 threes and 2 eights? I'll come and have a look in a minute. I'm surprised, but pleasantly surprised perhaps. No square roots, no factorials, no recurring decimals. The diameter of the Earth is, what is it really? It's not really 12,735 to us. We're going to see that as
13,000.
Roughly 13,000. And that 13 then sort of flashes at you from the next line, doesn't it? Huh? But it's going to take a long time for them to get there. But the sun is what? It's roughly 100 times bigger. Sorry, I mean the diameter is 100 times as great. So we've now got to think, how big's an orange? And again, we're now doing mathematics, so we don't mind choosing a nice number that's about right. What's a good measure for the diameter of an orange?
10 centimeters.
10 centimeters. Why not? It's a pretty close. And if that's 10 centimeters, the Earth is going to be what? 1 millimeter. Right? Getting this conception of how puny we are. And how far away can it be? Okay, so some of these, all of these, the steps are complicated, and you want people to learn to make them as best they can. So that was my second point, whatever it was. I've forgotten what it was now, but never mind. Third, and I'm running out of time fast, but never mind, let's whiz on. School mathematics should seek to convey somehow not just these calculational aspects of mathematics, but what I would call the objective structure, the objective character, the logical structure, and the inner aesthetic of mathematics. I wouldn't write these words in a curriculum, but I think we want to have them engraved on our hearts. So let's have a look at some of these aspects, which is going to be done too fast, and you aren't going to be able to take notes, I'm afraid, because I'm going to be... I want you to whiz through this and sort of help me. Pretend I'm the poor teacher who's got to finish. So we've got three axioms of Euclid, which are construction axioms. To draw a straight line segment AB joining any given points A and B. If you've got a segment, to extend it as far as you like in either direction, and to construct a circle given 2 points A and B, center A through B. Okay? And off he goes. Given points AB to construct an equilateral triangle ABC. Is this completely standard? Yes? Center at A, circle through B, center at B, circle through A, meeting in 2 points, you've got your equilateral triangle. Okay, so that's where he started. It's a pretty simple beginning. Proposition one. Proposition two is already quite interesting. What does he ask for? So he's given... He doesn't want to pick up his compasses, so he says, suppose I've got a segment over here and a point over here. How do I construct a copy of this down here? Using just those axioms. That's quite an interesting exercise. I'll come back to it in a minute if somebody wants to think how to do it. Already proposition two has got cleverness built in. Proposition 3 then says, given two segments, I want to take the bigger. I'm trying to do a subtraction in geometry. And you want to subtract the smaller from the larger, so you use proposition 2 to take AB to CX, and then use the compasses to swing that round and get CX dashed as a subsegment of CD. Okay. Before we leave this, what do you do? Do I know? You can take that segment and construct an equilateral triangle. Then you can extend using axiom 2 that. Then you can center here, do that. Yeah? Don't want to do that? Oh no, I didn't want to do that. I know what I wanted to do. I wanted to do it on there, didn't I? On the extension of this. Now center here, circle through there. And that's what we want. So you have to use proposition 1 to construct an equilateral triangle and then somehow get this down based at C. It's a little bit obtuse, but quite fun. So, constructions. Then proposition 4 is just not really a proposition at all. It's SAS congruence. 5 and 6 are isosceles triangles and converse. And on it goes until some point he has to use his other two axioms, one of which, slightly curiously, is that all right angles are equal or congruent. But this is important to try and match what happens over here with what happens over here. There's no reason. A right angle is just half a straight angle. And there's no a priori reason why what happens over there should happen over there. You probably would never mention this to kids, but there it is, and the parallel axiom gets used at some point before we get to Pythagoras. Now, I think Pythagoras' own proof of Pythagoras' theorem is, I suspect, not what most of you use, but it's so beautiful that you should at least have it in your locker room to use. So you have a right angle at A, and it says the square on BC is equal to the square, sum of the squares on AB and AC. Now, as a mathematician, you look at this right angle triangle, there's only one point that leaps out at you as being special. Which is it? Well, I've only marked 3 points, so you've got to choose one from three. Which one's special? It's a right angle triangle. A, right? A special. So you're going to do something to do with A, and you want to see why that plus that is equal to that. There's only one line you can construct through A, really, for a right angle triangle. You could go off in all sorts of directions, but none of these lines are screaming out to be drawn. It's a right angle triangle. The only line you can draw from A is the one perpendicular to BC. That's the only line God and his angels are begging you to draw. And if you do that, is it possible that God is good? Is it really possible that that plus that is equal to that because that is equal to that? Well, yes, God is sometimes good. That's part of the inner aesthetic, part of the amazing. Now, I reckon that just sort of would knock you out. If you were 14 or 15 and, yeah, we had at breakfast, how do you persuade them that they're interested? Well, I don't think you have to. I think mathematics will do it for you if you let it. That is equal to that. Why? Well, it's not. Of course, to see wonderful things like that, you have to do something. You have to pay a price. What's the price here? Well, you have to draw this line. And this triangle, we've already had proposition before 47. This is a triangle that has this as base and this as height. So it's half of this rectangle at the bottom. Yeah? So we need, what about this thing? Well, here we have to look at that and that and that. This is the same as this. This is the side of a square, so it's the same as this. This angle here is 90 plus that one. And this was 90 plus that one. So SAS tells you these two triangles are congruent. And this one has this as base and that as height. So it's half of that square. But this beautiful, why is that plus that equal to that? All these dissection proofs that people, are you encouraged to use them? People wear them on t-shirts. There are millions of, I think the dissection proofs are bewildering. I can never remember them. But this, God is asking you to do exactly that. And I think it's a wonderful thing. But just so that you, I'm not just doing that to teach you something 2,000 years old that you probably know already. There's a rather lovely little twist. Pythagoras is not dead. This is due to Edgar Dijkstra, who died recently. If you capture Pythagoras' theorem, it says that if the angle at A is a right angle, then using the normal convention of the side opposite A is little a. Do you have that convention? Mm-hmm. Yeah? Then A squared is B squared plus C squared. What's a good way to write that? Well, the angle at A is not just pi by 2. If it's pi by 2, it's also equal to the sum of the other two angles. Yeah? If the angle at A is a right angle, then the sum of B and C is a right angle. So we get this rather unusual formulation, that if A, the angle A, is equal to the angle B plus the angle C, then little a squared is equal to little b squared plus little c squared. And there's also the converse of Pythagoras' theorem, which is true, which often doesn't get its fair sort of walk-on part. So that's the sort of dotted backwards implications which I put in. And if you read this as an if and only if, okay, I'm not saying use if and only if in school, but for us, okay? If you read this as an if and only if, it's asking you to formulate something else. It's saying that the angle A is not equal to B plus C precisely when little a squared is not equal to little b squared plus little c squared. And that then gradually sort of suggests, hey, hang on, maybe if angle A is bigger than B plus C, little a squared is bigger than B squared plus C squared. Maybe, in fact, there are two theorems hiding in here. And if you look at 1, 2, and 3, there are three if and only if equivalences there, or six theorems, and they can all be captured if you introduce A minus B plus C, or B plus C minus A, and introduce what's called the sign. The sign of B plus C minus A is equal to the sign of B squared plus C squared minus A squared, is the thing in the box. There are these six theorems. There are two parts of 1, two parts of 2, two parts of 3. I haven't proved any of them. I proved Pythagoras. I proved one of the six theorems. But there's more lurking in Pythagoras' theorem than one knows. Okay, so these are things one can unpack. What am I going to... I now have to make a difficult choice to finish off. You can't have any of that lovely stuff. Isn't that sad? Oh, well, we'll have to save that for another time. I was going to do some interesting stuff on primes, but I shan't do any of that. We'll be saved all that. So, part of what comes out of these examples is that I would suggest that mathematics, even school mathematics, is inescapably abstract. It doesn't mean it should be presented abstractly, but it does mean we should be aware that what we are trying to convey and get across cannot be made street-friendly. There is something about it which is inescapably abstract. 2 plus 3 you may be able to do on your fingers. 17 plus 24 you can't. So somehow, if you're going to get as far as 17 plus 24, which is presumably grade 1, 2 or something, then you're already having to escape from the concrete to some other realm. A half and a third, you can get an idea of what half a pie is or what a third of a pint of milk is or whatever. Oh, you have litres probably here. But as soon as you write things like two-thirds, there is something inescapably abstract about it. If it stays concrete, they want to evaluate it. But the idea of two-thirds as an entity is already somehow abstract. 14 elevenths is definitely abstract. I've no real feeling for 14 elevenths in detail. A over B, well, it ain't much different from 14 elevenths. Two-thirds plus 14 elevenths? Well, the only way I can handle this is by going through procedures which are in some mathematical realm rather than in a concrete realm. Two-thirds divide... Of course, I can go back to the concrete realm to try and cement the foundations, to clarify what's going on, to reinforce the understanding. But I don't really operate, I don't want kids to operate in that concrete domain longer than is necessary to make the step step up to the abstract domain. 2/3 divided by 14/11, we're all completely in the formal domain of mathematics. Points, triangles, circles, regular polygons, prime numbers, infinity, which you've all missed, that's the bit you didn't get. These are all, in some sense, abstract, even though they have their reflections in the real world. Okay. And this is a quote from a much underused set of Socratic dialogues by Reni, a Hungarian probabilist and statistician. The conclusion is this: mathematics is concerned with mental objects. We have much more certain knowledge about persons and things which exist only in our imagination, for example, about characters in a play. Characters in a play, you're fairly sure whether they committed the murder or didn't, because a play is an unreal world. Of course, clever plays leave you unsure who did it. But in some sense, in the fictional world, you can be fairly sure about things, rather than in the living world where you don't. The situation is the same in mathematics. We may be sure that the diagonals of a rectangle are equal because this follows from the definition of a rectangle. The new concepts invented by mathematicians are like new ships which carry the discoverer further in the great sea of thought. But what's the use of exploring the wonderful sea of thought? How is it that knowledge about this world of thought, this abstract world, think back to Steiner's comments about the impact of the mathematical world on the world we live in, the alphabet of just perception. How is it that knowledge of this world can be used to answer everyday questions about the real world? Well, that's the answer is not the simple-minded one that one would be tempted to make in connection with numeracy. That, well, it's the numbers are numbers of real things, and so if we teach it in that way, then people will be able to survive. So my final points are a little bit more philosophical, and you may not like them. I don't really have a feeling for BC. You have your own way of life out here. Ottawa's a long way away, and maybe England is even further. Mathematics gives human beings almost their only glimpse. Now, not only, but one of the main ways of glimpsing the difference between transience and permanence, between subjectivity, me, my rules, what I think, and objectivity, what some mathematical god thinks. Religion used to offer this, but as part of the grand scheme, this tended to get undermined. Things are not what they were on that front. And again, I appeal to Steiner for a long quote, which I will just give you extracts of. The thrust of will which engenders art, and although that's not what goes on in your classroom all the time, I claim it's what we should have in our minds when teaching even the most mundane and obstreperous classes of 16-year-olds. The thrust of will which engenders art and disinterested thought, the engaged response which alone can ensure its transmission to other human beings, to the future, are rooted in a gamble on transcendence. Why do we care about Euclid? It's something of more lasting value than any of us. And part of what one's trying to convey in school is this reaching for something more permanent than just the next burger or the next CD or the next pair of trainers or the next whatever. The writer or thinker means the words of the poem, the sinews of the argument, the personae of the drama, to outlast his own life, to take on the mystery of autonomous presence and presentness. Right? The sculptor commits to the stone the vitalities against and across time which will soon drain from his own living hand. Okay, it's dramatic, it's poetic, but I suggest it's something which should be part of the mathematics that we teach. There is more, I'm afraid, of that. We are in a dilemma because I suggest that this tension between permanence and transience is an integral part of mathematics, at whatever level you teach it. And yet, it's not fashionable. So this logic and its idiom are now eroded. The notion axiomatic in classic art and thought of sacrificing present life, present humanity, to the marginal chance of future literary or intellectual renown, grates on modern nerves. there is very much a living in the present. A lot of, we were discussing over breakfast, boredom. A lot of sort of ennui. This who cares is part of something that the older ones amongst us find difficult to swallow, because it needn't be there, it wasn't always there, and I think as part of mathematics it's our job to try and make sure there will be a time when it is no longer there. So I'm only saying this reevaluation of the criteria of lastingness, of individual mastery against time, is as radical and as far-reaching as it now seems. The core of the very concept of culture will have been broken. There is some sense in which this switch we have witnessed in all Western democracies, despite the fact that our current prosperity and well-being owe almost everything to the openness, the science and mathematics, which we all value, there has been a reaction against it. Enrollments for university mathematics, science, engineering courses tend to have collapsed. I don't know whether it's accurate, but I was given a figure of, in Holland, there are only 100 math majors in the different universities. This happens to be a country where the curriculum development and curriculum reform has been of world renown. So it comes back to what I was saying at the beginning. Reforms that are meant to improve things often have unwanted consequences. And so when we're trying to think through how to improve on the current state, good intentions are not enough. You may want things to improve, you may work very hard to design something which you believe will improve it, but try to remember some of the background spirit of mathematics. If you let go of that somehow, if one compromises with the political demands of democracies, who I assume from Mr. McCaskill's remarks, there are political pressures that kids shouldn't fail. Right? Grade 8, 9, everybody should come through and feel good about themselves. Well, in mathematics that's difficult, and I don't think we should necessarily feel bad about it. But we do need to think about the learner as well as the subject. So, thank you very much. Anybody done 2 8s and 2 3s? I want to go and look at this. Okay.
It's thank you, Tony, for your inspiring talk. And I must say, I'm enough of a British Columbian to have my heart starting to beat a little faster when you say that not everybody should walk out of the classroom feeling good about themselves. I think it might be possible if we just took sports as our model. It's not so mysterious. In sports, they do the right thing. It's hard. Sometimes I'm not good enough for the team, but I still feel good about myself.
Okay.